Okay, this is Jeff Spittler, July 16th, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 32. Okay, well, last time we covered the interlude between the First and Second Bishops' Wars in about 1639 and the beginning of 1640. Charles had hoped mainly to stall for time while he furthered his preparations for a second attack. As you'll see, it didn't quite turn out as he might have hoped. But he continued negotiations at some level, and he allowed a general assembly to meet in Edinburgh in August of 1639. He sent the Earl of Traquair as his commissioner, though, as we noted last week, he was hardly suited for the role, tending to sort of side with whoever he happened to be present with at the time. The general assembly again reiterated most of the decisions made by the Glasgow assembly. This was to honor one of the things that the king asked for, is that that assembly not be treated as binding. So they, in this essence, didn't. They went back and passed all the acts again. Okay, the assembly was followed by a parliament of which the king's commissioner, the Earl of Traquair, lost control of the parliament. In November, the king ordered that it be prorogued or suspended until June of 1640. The parliament initially refused. But then they agreed basically not to cease because the king had ordered him to do so, but just to be polite. Charles agreed to hear a commission of the Covenanters and this in February and through early April of 1640. He had meetings with them. And then finally, on the 11th of April, he, having discovered this supposedly treasonous letter, to the King of France, he had four of the commissioners thrown into the Tower of London. Okay. Having attempted to create a suitable media crisis, as it were, he called Parliament for the first time in a number of years. Unfortunately for him, Parliament wasn't very interested in the so-called Scottish problems, and they took up their own grievances. And so after a few months, they Charles suspended the parliament because he wasn't getting his way. Mike.
How did he create this suitable media crisis? Did he take a poll?
No, I think if, you'll see his complete failure, among other things, is he didn't take polls. That might be why he failed, is because he didn't have pollsters to tell him what the real opinion of the people was. Yeah, and we already saw how last week the Earl of Traquair, you know, had done his vote count in the parliament and gotten it wrong. So. Okay, so Charles was now sort of between the proverbial rock and a hard place. He had hoped to go back to war with the Covenanters under more advantageous conditions, and now it looked like he would have to go back under less advantageous conditions. His request for funds, of course, wasn't done in secret, so, you know, the Covenanters knew absolutely that he was planning to go back to war with them. He did manage to raise some funds and money, funds and men from other sources, particularly Ireland. And he was being pushed to invade Scotland by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was Laud, and the Earl of Strafford, who had been his Governor General in Ireland. In June of 1640, Parliament started a meeting. Charles tried to suspend their meeting then, but they had sort of multiple conflicting directives, and they took the one that they wanted, which was to continue to meet. And they officially continued their preparations for war. Right. We discussed last time some of the preparations just in terms of mustering men and roll calls and practice and so on. Okay, well, we went that far last week. The end of July 1640, a general assembly had been appointed to meet by Charles in Aberdeen, okay, evidently attempting to borrow a play, if you will, from his father's book. Charles had probably hoped that if he had the location in Aberdeen, which was the sort of the most episcopacy favoring part of the country, that the location would prove conducive to his cause. But since most of the prelates had fled Scotland by now, it was pretty much a bust. It was, in terms of from Charles's perspective. One comment, which I guess is not in my notes, but that whereas the previous two general assemblies had been widely attended by lay elders, this one was much less so. perhaps partly because a lot of the lay elders had gotten their issues settled in the last two assemblies, perhaps partly because it was in Aberdeen. One of the issues that came up with in this assembly, that it comes up again later on in Scottish church history, but it's this issue of private prayer meetings or conventicles. Okay, during the years when the Scottish church had been under the thumb of, well, James and Charles, perhaps more so, and under the thumb of the Archbishop Laud, there had been a lot of private prayer meetings going on that were sometimes called conventicles. After the church had been reformed again, what we might call is commonly called the Second Reformation, the conventicles continued. Okay, they were also very common in England among the Puritans. So part of the church felt that they fostered Brownist tendencies, and Brownists would be independents and separatists. I'm not sure if there's any other connotations to the term, but Brown was actually a guy in England who was trying to get basically have an independent and separate church. Well-known, use the term conservative ministers were on both sides of this issue. Alexander Henderson and David Calderwood had earlier tried to pass an act in General Assembly against conventicles, and David Dixon, Robert Blair, and Samuel Rutherford defended them. They defended conventicles. So it wasn't a case of like the prelates against the Presbyterians or something. There were Presbyterians on both sides of this issue. I guess some basically felt that the conventicles could be, schismatic eventually. They could lead to things that were not good. But others felt that they were very useful for promoting piety, and the term they used was mutual edification. And furthermore, if they were too critical of private prayer meetings, it was partly then also sort of it was a negative against the Puritans in England, who were where conventicles and private prayer meetings were quite common. Presumably, they were also quite common, partly for the same reasons they had been common in England and that are common in Scotland previously. Okay, several recent authors, David Stevenson and John Coffey. I think Coffey, probably following Stevenson, have characterized the two parties as the moderate party, that would be the ones against conventicles, and the radical party for conventicles. Stevenson, who among other things has written a paper entitled The Radical Party in the Kirk, 1637-1645, said, "The radicals, partly through English Puritan influence, partly through the critical attitude developed while opposing the king that all details of worship must be justified by Scripture, wanted to purge the Kirk of several traditional practices which they erroneously claimed were innovations. Moderates indignantly defended these well-loved practices." Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to obtain the article that probably would have covered what the practices were. And, of course, this is just his characterization of it, but I thought it was interesting that he characterized it partly as a regulative principle issue. But again, I'm not exactly sure what the particulars were, so it's a little difficult to say. The assembly also passed an act abolishing monuments of idolatry. I haven't seen that act, but the act that ratified it in Parliament mentioned idolatrous images, crucifixes, pictures of Christ, and all other idolatrous pictures. Okay, so you might think of the Presbyterians as iconoclasts, which I guess they were, but they weren't violent iconoclasts. The pictures and images were to be removed from all kirks, colleges, chapels, and other public places, but it allowed the owners 3 months to remove all the images. So after which time, then, sheriffs, stewards, baileys, magistrates of burghs and regalities were to raise, demolish, abolish, cast down, or deface all these idolatrous images. It's all in good time, 3 months. So, okay, they adjourned on the 5th of August, so it was comparatively short General Assembly compared to the last two. Okay, in the meantime, In the south of the country, the Scottish troops were assembling near the town of Duns, which is near the border. By the end of July, they had a fairly large force established, or assembled. There have been various estimates on its size, but Hewison says, or believes, there are about 20,000 infantry, 4,000 cavalry, and a large train of well-horsed wagons and covered tumbrils in which artillery was concealed. Let's see, let me quote a little more from him. These irregulars in hodden gray and tartan formed a motley crowd. Few had corselets and iron skulls. Firearms, swords, and iron-shod quarterstaves were borne by the infantry. The horsemen carried swords, pistols, and pikes. The long, cumbrous Scots spear is not mentioned. The fierce Highlanders carried bows and arrows, as well as their irresistible broadswords. Okay, most of the soldiers would not have been Highlanders, but some were. All wore blue bonnets, as Sir Walter Scott's version of a contemporary song records. March, march, Estelle and Liddesdale, all the blue bonnets are over the border. Along with the colors displaying the motto, Covenant for Religion, Crown, and Country, marched resolute military chaplains, namely Alexander Henderson, Robert Blair, John Livingston, Robert Bailey, Andrew Kent, George Gillespie, and other country pastors. Okay, so we certainly know some of those names. Yes, 1640. Yes, July of 1640. We're on the. This is actually considered to be one of the first British civil wars. So there's actually a series of we'll say wars. As you can see, this is a pretty short war. But okay, the king, on the other hand, had trouble raising funds. Right, he had to dismiss Parliament, so he had no way to tax. Or no way to legally tax. He'd been trying some other means. Let's see, again, according to Hewison, and you may appreciate this, he gathered a raw force, which he managed to pay for a time by selling, under cost price, a large quantity of pepper which he had secured on credit. Melancholy was the past when the English army had to be maintained on condiments. I thought that was funny. Okay. Let's see. The king's forces were scattered at this point through the north of England. He was still trying to muster his forces. And at this point, the Scottish Committee of Estates had a hard decision to make. On the one hand, if the troops remained in Scotland in a defensive posture, they'd probably eventually run low on supplies, and if they'd been forced at that point to negotiate with the king, they might... again, be on less desirable terms than they'd like. On the other hand, if they invaded England, it might rally public opinion behind the king. It turns out some of the king's opponents in England, or we certainly, one of them was a very strong opponent of the Earl of Strafford, encouraged them to go to invade England. So they did invade England, and... English support in terms of military aid didn't materialize at all, but they did actually have the support of a number of the peers of England. So on the 3rd of August, the Committee of States ordered them to invade England, and they also ordered the production of some pamphlets which explained their justification for invading England, one of which was entitled Six Considerations of the Lawfulness of Our Expedition into England Manifested. They claimed that they weren't invading England to attack the king, or England, but rather they were attacking the Canterburyan faction of Papists, Atheists, Arminians, Prelates, the misleaders of the King's Majesty, and the common enemies of both kingdoms. They were attempting to link the two nations together in straighter and stronger bonds, both of civil and Christian love, than ever before. Actually, there is a sense, I think, in which this really, really and truly happened as an outcome, although I don't know if you could have foreseen it at the time. Among the more... superfluous arguments was they wished access to their king. England was their highway to the foot of the throne. The English were probably not aware that it was an immemorial custom of the Scots to be fully armed when visiting their king. So. Okay, it turns out not all of the Scots nobility, as you might imagine, were happy with this turn of events. Some began to have second thoughts, although it's a bit vague as to exactly what parts they were... opposed to. But the most well-known is the Earl of Montrose. But a total of 20 nobles and barons or gentry signed the so-called Cumbernauld Bond, which is, if you read it, a remarkably vague document. But it begins, Whereas we undersubscribers, out of our duty to religion, king, and country, were forced to join ourselves in a covenant for the maintenance and defense of either and every one of other in that behalf. Now finding how that, this is the key phrase, by particular and indirect practicing of a few, the country and cause now depending does so much suffer, do heartily hereby, and then they give all their terms of mutual aid and defense and so on. So it's really hard to say what they meant. They were apparently referring to the Earl of Argyle. I think it was maybe a familial jealousy. He had risen to prominence as the sort of covenanter leader. A few months later, 12 of them signed an explanatory declaration that says when they signed that, they weren't doing anything prejudicial to the covenant. So it's pretty hard to understand. But Montrose eventually does switch sides, and he claims as his justification that the original covenant and covenanters were well justified in their actions, but they'd gone beyond what they were justified to do. But at this point, his loyalties are still hidden. They'll be suspect for some time. Okay, on the 17th of August, then, in 1640, the advance guard entered England, and on the 20th, 3 days later, the main body crossed the Tweed. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, for Charles, his forces weren't quite ready yet. He had a sort of, if you will, an advance force of 4,000 men that met the Covenanter army in battle at Newburn Ford on the Tyne River. Know where that's at, Simon?
Vaguely.
It's near to Newcastle, but let's see. Let me read you. This is instead of a contemporary account, this is a modern account. It's from the same book that I used last week, but it gives a sort of short, popular description of the battle, if I can find it. Let's see. Apparently, Leslie, the Scottish general, had decided what he would do instead of attacking the Newcastle from the north side, he was going to attack from the south. That's why he crossed the Tyne, which runs roughly east-west at that point into Newcastle. It fell to Lord Conway to block this advance. He arrived at Newburn Ford on 27th August with approximately 2,000 foot, 1,500 horse, and 4 cannons, and set all hands to building barricades. Although Sir Jacob Astley brought him 2,000 reinforcements the next day, the English were still hopelessly outnumbered. According to Conway's own account, he would have retreated to Newcastle had he not, quote, at that instant received a letter from the Earl of Strafford, commanding him to fight. With little time to organize his defenses, Conway's fortifications were to prove ineffective. Captain Thomas Dymock later described how the Scottish army appeared marching on the hills above the ford when we were drawing into our miserable works in the valley where we lay so exposed to their battery that their great shot was bowled in amongst our men to their great loss. Let's see, Alexander Leslie had installed a light cannon on top of Newburn Church from where it played freely upon the English lines. The 4 English cannons returned fire with a noisy but ineffective bombardment. Under this exchange, the Scots began to cross the ford around 4 o'clock this afternoon, advancing doggedly amid the spumes of water kicked up by the splash of English musket balls. Seeing this, the English, who had no heart for the fight, abandoned their best defense of the barricades. Putting up no more than a scattered resistance, they bolted. Thus the Second Bishop's War ended much like the first, almost before it had really begun. It wasn't quite over yet, but that was almost the whole thing right there. Let's see. Leslie then moved his troops into Newcastle and occupied it on the 30th of August. Dumbarton Castle, which is northwest of Glasgow, surrendered on the 27th of August. Edinburgh Castle, as you'll recall, last time when the king got control of Edinburgh Castle, again, he immediately began fortifying it and stocking it. When the war started, the castle was bombarding Edinburgh with cannon shot. It killed almost 200 people, but they were forced to surrender on the 15th of September. They'd run low on water. Okay, and while the Covenanters' position was by no means secure at this point, they were occupying Newcastle, but there's nothing to keep the rest of the king's forces from, say, marching into the lowlands in Scotland. Well, their position maybe wasn't that good. The king's position was even worse, right? This defeat at Newburn Ford had been a major embarrassment. 12 English peers petitioned the king, to convene a parliament in order to try the king's evil counselors and to work out a peace with the Covenanters. So in terms of support, I said they didn't come militarily to the aid, but you know, basically he's now facing, in essence, if you will, a mutiny on both sides. So the Scots are attacking openly, and 12 peers are saying, you know, you've gone the wrong course, and we'd like to try your counselors. The Covenanters also petitioned the king, basically for the same things. Faced with yet another very difficult situation, he agreed not to a parliament, but to a council of peers. Okay, so he assembled the nobility of the kingdom in York on the 24th of September. They convinced him to call a parliament for the 3rd of November, 1640, and to appoint a commission to end the war, or to negotiate an end to the war. Okay, because both sides were actually still at arms. Again, Charles showing his sort of remarkably poor judgment. Of course, I guess his poor judgment came from the training he received from his father. But he directed the negotiators use the Treaty of Berwick as the basis for the peace. That's what they were supposed to work from. But since the Covenanters had only ever accepted that treaty because he made all these verbal promises on the side, and then he repudiated his promises literally within days of having made the agreement, they weren't going to go for that, and they had the upper hand. So they basically, their demands were met, which were, first of all, that for agreeing to a ceasefire, they would be paid to maintain their army, £850 per day, which I don't know the exact value of 1640 currency in today's economy, but that was a lot of money. And then the actual peace treaty was to be worked out not with the king as before, but with the king and the parliament, English parliament. So they were to be a party to the peace treaty. Okay, this was obvious because they didn't trust Charles. Okay, and this agreement was called the Treaty of, is it Ripon or Ripon? Ripon. Thank you, Simon. Okay, well, Charles finally, he had called this parliament for the 3rd of November. This is the so-called Long Parliament, which was in session for a number of years. But at this point, it was just intended to solve the immediate crisis, which was to pay off the Scots so they would go home. In his opening speech to Parliament, he called the Scots rebels who should be chased out of England. But see, he didn't have any polls, Mike. And so he later then he had to do what all politicians tend to do, which is backpedal. Yeah, basically, that's not really what he meant, you know. We found out Parliament was, you know, pretty sympathetic with the Scots in general. The Scottish commissioners arrived on the 10th of November. They were representatives of each estate. I forget the exact breakdown. But in addition to representatives of the nobility, gentry, and burgesses, there were four ministers, Robert Blair, Robert Bailey, John Smith, and George Gillespie. Okay, the Parliament gave them a church building to use, and they preached to crowds that are reported to have been large and enthusiastic. Okay, it took some time. In fact, the Treaty of London wasn't actually agreed to until the 10th of August, 1641, so the negotiations went on. I think they were pretty much concluded by June, but they went on some time. Okay, and the English Parliament, as the Scots had demanded, was one of the parties to the treaty. And the terms included, first of all, Charles agreed to publish the acts of the June 1640 Scottish Parliament under his name. Right, he initially had insisted that the Parliament was illegal because it had met without his permission, but this had the effect of approving all of the acts of the Glasgow and Edinburgh General Assemblies, establishing a Scottish Parliament without bishops, which they had decided on at that parliament, and eliminating his control over the Lords of the Articles, right? He set the agenda for the entire parliament. Also, parliament was scheduled to meet at least once every 3 years. Okay, so he agreed to that actually surprisingly quickly, and there were actually hopes that this whole thing might be concluded quickly. Actually, the English parliament didn't want to conclude so quickly, because as long as the Scots were negotiating, that gave them some extra leverage with their own grievances. Let's see, other terms of the treaty. Royal castles in Scotland were to be used only for defending the realm. Covenanters in England and Ireland were not to be persecuted for having signed the national covenant. The king's advisors, if judged incapable, in other words, if they were really found to be at the least evil counselors misleading the king, he agreed they would be fired and have no more access to his person. Captured Scottish ships and goods would be returned. And for their troubles, the Scots were given, there's two accounts, either 220,000 pounds or 300,000 pounds indemnity. The English Parliament called it brotherly assistance. Okay, but that was in addition to the 850 pounds per day. Or, I don't know, there's some possibility that maybe the discrepancy in the numbers, one includes the, I don't know, one includes the pounds per day and the other doesn't. Let's see, agreed that all declarations, proclamations, and books published against the Covenanters would be withdrawn and suppressed. And a reciprocal claim was agreed to that such materials published in Scotland against the king would likewise be withdrawn, although the Scottish Parliament was to be the judge of whether or not they were injurious to the king. So it's not clear that that would actually be enforced in the way the king would have liked. Okay. There were more treaty demands. One of the key things that the Scots wanted was uniformity of religion. In other words, episcopacy would be banned in England, and Presbyterianism would be established. The reasons they put forward were primarily civil, and that this would lead to peace between England and Scotland. This was an age when many of the conflicts, wars were fought over religion. Okay, but to this, the king wouldn't agree, which he might have been too bad, but also a majority in Parliament wouldn't agree to this term. And again, according to Stevenson, he says, a few English Puritans wanted Scots Presbyterianism established in England, though they did not openly admit this for fear of losing the support of their Scots allies in other matters. From what I've read, that seems to be a reasonable interpretation, but of course, interpretations of what the English wanted may, you know, that may be subject to interpretation. But they agreed, therefore, only to a pursuing conformity of church government, and that to be done at some future indefinite date. Okay, finally, some minor actions with respect to cooperation between the civil governments were made. Neither country would make war on the other without approval of its parliament. So if England wanted to make war on Scotland, the English Parliament would have to approve, and vice versa. Also, they would come to each other's mutual aid and defense against common enemies and some other, you know, sort of civil cooperation type terms. Okay, while this treaty negotiation was underway, the English Parliament had arrested both Archbishop Laud and the Earl of Strafford. Let's see, Strafford was tried on 28 charges, which amounted cumulatively to treason. He was executed on the 12th of May, 1641, actually during that during the treaty negotiations. Laud, and for reasons I don't really know, but his treaty or his trial didn't happen until 1644. Presumably, he stayed in the Tower all that time. He was executed on the 10th of January, 1645, partly for being a bad advisor to the king, but partly also. I mean, he had definitely persecuted. His policy was for the Puritans, they cut off ears and tongues and, was it slit noses or something like that? And he'd definitely been a persecutor. So I'm sure that didn't help his cause when he was finally tried. Okay, so we're going to stop there, having reached a conclusion to the Second Bishops' War and, a formal conclusion by way of a treaty. Questions, Mike?
You know, doesn't it follow that King put those advisors in there because he liked those advisors, right?
One would think if you were the king, you were sovereign to put whatever advisors in that you wanted.
If the advisors would give you advice, how can you turn around and try them for giving you that advice?
Well, that's a good question. We, I think we see basically the same thing over and over again. This is a motif or theme of certainly of Scottish history in that time, and I guess English also. And that was, there was this reverence for the king, right? I mean, James, of course, had made a big deal about claiming his divine right as king, and that in fact, even if he was wrong, it was too bad. That was the God's punishment on the people, and that he, the king, only had to answer to God. And obviously, the Scottish revolution, or whatever you want to call it here, was a serious challenge to that. But nevertheless, they still maintained this kind of awe of the king that today we can't understand, but that's what they did.
To the extent that they wouldn't even say they were fighting the king, they were invading it.
Right. So, you know, they said they were basically fighting to, you know, to get the king's advisors. Of course, in Scottish history, there was, I mean, if you recall, like, James's minority, right? He was, getting the person of the king was an important step to political power. So, and maybe one of the reasons why James had such a big thing about the absolute, the absolute despotism, well, that's not the word he used, of the king. At the same time, one of the things that supposedly there had been discussions, and this is all mostly hearsay, of deposing Charles amongst the Covenanters. And in fact, there's a, you know, there's actually some political fallout. I don't know if we'll cover it or not, but the king comes to Scotland in 1641, and one of the things he'd like to do is try these people who are wanting to depose him. And he has a witness, an eyewitness, who claims that the Earl of Argyll, right, the Covenanter leader, was one of them. But then, once the witness is closely cross-examined, he admits that only that they were talking about deposition of kings in general, not Charles in specific. Although, that would obviously be the application at hand. So, yeah. To give you a sort of long answer, yeah, it does appear that they had an affinity or reverence for their king that, well, at least we have a very hard time understanding today. So,
these conventicles that caused somewhat of a difference of opinion, at least amongst the in the Church of Scotland. Were these the seeds of the Free Church movement in Scotland, or can you trace that far?
I don't think. Well, I don't know if they would. I don't know if they'd claim that or not. It's. I mean, I'm only looking ahead. You know, looking ahead to the times when the Covenanters are persecuted, it's clearly the seeds of their willingness to. As soon as the Restoration happened and the Church was once again hijacked by the King, that their willingness to go to private meetings, brush arbors, as Mike would say, and. So, yeah, it definitely goes to that. I guess the Free Church seems to have sort of more immediate, I guess more immediate roots from my view, which is that they didn't try to, when they had this disruption and they split off from the Church of Scotland, it was over issues related to church government and impositions by the government, but it didn't seem to be, it didn't, as far as I know, it didn't come out of conventicle type movement or anything like that, but I could be wrong. I haven't really carefully studied it, so.
Just a question. I noticed when the Covenanters
were trying to clear out
the blatantism. I'm sorry, I didn't clear.
Clean out blatantism? Oh, right.
What sort of blatantism was going on at that time? This is the scene where they already.
Well, the Anglican Church had been pretty much taken over by Arminians. Now, I won't, at least in terms of its hierarchy. So, in fact, like the Archbishop prior to Laud, I think, was more of a Calvinist. But by when Laud sort of became Archbishop. Right, that represented, if you will, the ascendancy of Arminianism or semi-Pelagianism, anyways, in the Anglican Church hierarchy. So it had actually swept through the Church and was a major Or maybe I should say a dominant force. I don't mean to say that they were all Arminians, because they definitely weren't, but there were certainly a lot of Arminians in the English church, and certainly they had control in terms of the bishops and archbishops. So, and it, as we talked a number of weeks ago, it's a little bit different from sort of a, what we typically think of in terms of Arminianism and how it worked itself out. It had this sort of sacerdotal emphasis, the real presence being one of the real presence in the communion in the host. That was one of the issues that they were. So, other questions? Mary. That's a good question. What caused? I mean, I think you could say the military force caused them to, I mean, allow them to put some of their things into practice in terms of like being able to treat directly with the king in a meaningful way. And before, they had been under the king's thumb. But I guess before that was probably the Charles's failure to understand the mood of the people that allowed him. I mean, basically what happened over a period of years is he kept putting new innovations on the church and on Parliament, and what he didn't realize was he just kept alienating more and more people. And meanwhile, there were these private conventicles, and there was a real evangelical Christianity, if you will, sort of underground in the church. And I think what finally happened is that basically public sentiment just overwhelmingly shifted to the sort of covenanter viewpoint, the anti-Charles viewpoint. There were also some real revivals that went on in the 1620s, I guess, primarily, but that had a significant impact on the church. So, I mean, I guess ultimately, God, you know, God is sovereign and had sort of various means to bring about the ends that he brought about. So it wasn't probably wasn't just one thing, but it was, I mean, clearly getting this widespread public support among the nobility and the people and so on led them to be able to create, you know, an army that would would fight for their right to govern the church as they saw fit.
Right. Isn't there sort of similarity here with the slickness? In fact, King James, if you associate with Clinton, they're probably pulled off. You know, because he kept on really having his way. And this is Charles, like Al Gore, who can't blend.
It's exactly like that, Mike. An exact analogy. I don't know. You might be able to have some fun with that, but definitely, you know, James had grown up in Scotland and at least understood the temper of the people a little bit better. Charles, you know, grew up in England. I mean, really didn't understand his Scottish subjects at all. And he only had sort of the ravings of his father and, you know, which we saw in the Basilican Doron and some other advice he gave to his son. You know, it was just really specious advice about how to rule, which would only work if you were truly an absolute monarch and really had the ability to enforce your will. And if you don't have that, you can't rule the way that James suggested to him. So, Simon.
It seems like Charles was restrained by the English Parliament in the way that James
was. Yeah. Definitely. And if probably, again, for some of the same reasons, he just further alienated alienated the English Parliament. And Charles, he just had an uncanny sense, or uncanny lack of sense, I guess, on how to negotiate and compromise. A lot of times he would agree to things, like if he'd agreed to them a year earlier or 3 months earlier, he probably would have been completely satisfactory. But by failing to do this, time and time again, he just gets himself into place where the other party is no longer in a mood to stop at that negotiating point. So, in fact, I think what you can see is that the Scots in this Treaty of London got a lot more than they ever would have expected after the First Bishops' War, if he'd been more conciliatory at that point. But like I've mentioned before, it's something like Pharaoh, God hardened his heart, you know, so that's where he ended up.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that the English Puritans wouldn't speak up for a Presbyterian form of government over against an Episcopal form. What was that? I mean, they were under persecution, but were they still in the Church of England? I mean, were they still hanging on to the fringes there? Or
some were, some weren't, and I think they. I guess, if in a sense, you could probably see, from a sort of human standpoint, two responses to persecution from an official church. Right, one is to reform the church and to make its government fit the Bible. Right, and that would be I would call that the Presbyterian viewpoint. Right, and the other one would be to say, well, this established church business is a bad idea. Let's separate from it, be independent, and that would go to America. And that's the other idea. And that's, I would say, that is the dominant idea here. Just, I mean, I think you could imagine the reaction if we went to the meeting of the National Association of Evangelicals and announced that we thought the solution was they should all join the Presbyterian Church and come under the Presbyterian form of church government. It might not be too positive. So.
They thought I'd bring out the Promise Keepers.
Yeah, and Promise Keepers, right. So. Yeah. No, I think that there are probably at least two responses to that sort of official persecution, and the English, I think, leaned a lot more the other way. So, okay. Well, let's stop there before Bruce has to eject me from the pulpit here. And Lang, would you close in prayer?